Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
And welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, South Africa marks Nelson Mandela Day for the first time since his death in December.
Madiba shaped and touched all our lives, and he lives in our minds one way or the other, and we are trying to live his legacy.
We will also be hearing how more and more people are coming forward to report cases of domestic violence in Ghana.
It could be domestic violence in a form of sexual abuse, physical, and any other form of violence that is a human rights abuse.
Just two of our stories in this edition of Africa Link. Stay tuned.
Top story.
South Africans have been marking Nelson Mandela Day for the first time since the anti-apartheid icon and former president died in December of last year. South Africans spent 1 hour and 7 minutes doing community work on this July the 18th. The 67 minutes standing for the 67 years Mandela spent fighting for social justice. Tuzo Kumalo reports.
7 months after his death, Mandela's legacy still lives on. South Africans went out in their numbers to spend 67 minutes of their time making a difference in other people's lives. Following the government's call on South Africans to use Mandela Day to clean up South Africa, many people came out to clean up their cities and neighborhoods. 47-year-old Vusine Vana chose to clean up his street in Johannesburg. He made it clear why he thinks that millions of South Africans are indebted to Mandela.
Well, Mandela said, if one man goes down, 1,000 more have to soldier on. So we have to soldier on. Because of his death, it doesn't mean things have to stop. No.
Other activities included the donation of books to schools and libraries. These included books on South Africa's first post-apartheid president. Panyanza Lesufi from the Executive Council for Education in the Gauteng province said that they directed their resources towards fulfilling Mandela's vision of education for all.
We'll ensure that there is a book about our former state president Nelson Mandela in all our school libraries so that at least each and every learner understand this icon and support this icon in their day-to-day work. We believe it is only through education that we can break the shackles of poverty.
Ahmed Kathrada, who was imprisoned together with Mandela at the Robben Island, joined in the Remembrance Day activities. He spent 18 years in prison. To him, the freedom gained after the apartheid era means that young people now have better education opportunities.
If under adverse conditions, people could study and get degrees. Now the doors are open to everybody to study. While they play, they should take full advantage of that so that they can serve themselves, their parents, and their country.
For Nelson Mandela's family, it was a very moving experience seeing so many people using the day to honor his memory. His granddaughter, Ndileka Mandela, urged South Africans to continue his work.
Although it is still hard for us as a family, but it is important that his work continue. And it is quite important that it is done on the first anniversary that we will be spending without granddad.
The United Nations recognized Mandela's birthday as an international day in 2009. It was inspired by Mandela's call for the next generation to take over the baton of leadership in addressing the world's social injustices, or as he said, it is in your hands.
Tuzo Kumalo reporting. What has changed in South Africa since Nelson Mandela's death? I've been talking to Daryl Glazer, Associate Professor of Politics at the University of Witwatersrand. I started by asking him about Mandela's legacy within the ANC. Was it being nurtured or disregarded?
Largely retired from the political scene for a long time prior to his death. And then after his death, we went through a period of concentrated national mourning. And I think we haven't sort of been thinking quite as much about Mandela since then. But of course, with the annual Mandela Day, where South Africans are called upon to perform 67 minutes of public service, his name gets revived. So he's back in the news. And if you like, the public reverence is being reignited. There's a kind of a national myth that's being deliberately created as a kind of unifying myth about Mandela as this benevolent father figure who calls upon his people to engage in benevolent acts.
Have you noticed any perceptible change in South African society over the last 7 months?
Now, of course, we've had the elections, the national elections since Mandela's death, and this has been really, I suppose, in terms of South African politics, the central talking point. And what we saw was that the ANC remained above 60% of the vote, but did suffer some loss and has now got this challenger on its left in the form of the Economic Freedom Fighters, which has been asking testing questions and making controversial statements in Parliament. And this against the backdrop of the country being in something of a state of disarray. There's still basic political and economic stability, but the economy is not generating enough jobs, and we've had a great deal of civil unrest and industrial unrest. And at the moment, it feels like we're muddling through. We're not really making great strides.
What about Mandela's surviving relatives? Are they still very much in the public eye, or have they faded from view since his death?
Like Mandela himself, apart from the reporting on the odd family squabble, they have faded from public view, but are now back in public view as a result of the Mandela Day. For example, some members of the Mandela family are being interviewed to talk about the legacy and being occasionally gently asked questions about tensions within the family.
Are there many younger politicians in South Africa who seek to actively emulate Nelson Mandela, who say his message of peace, reconciliation, tolerance, patience is something we can build on? Or does cynicism prevail?
Some cynicism prevails, but also a great deal of impatience. A lot of South Africans feel that not enough has changed in the last 20 years. Although there have been some social gains, there's still too much racial and economic inequality and poverty and unemployment. I think the dominant narrative is about how we need to move beyond conciliation and push for some more radical kind of change. So for those who feel threatened by that kind of talk, it's a nervous time. And of course, what it threatens to upset ANC's central achievement, which has been political and economic stability in the country.
Does Mandela still have a powerful influence over the rest of Africa?
I don't think he has a powerful influence over the rest of Africa. He is still cited with some reverence in the rest of Africa, just as he is in South Africa. And there is a sort of a stark contrast that someone was recently who travels in Africa telling me about how our current president Zuma is something of a figure of derision in much of Africa, like he is for a certain section of the population inside the country. And I suppose a lot of people across the continent draw a contrast between Zuma, who is indecisive, whose family appears to be corrupt to one degree or another, who seems to be largely self-interested. People draw a contrast between his style of leadership and the style that Mandela offered, which was that of a great statesman.
Darryl Glazer from the University of Witwatersrand.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
The rights group Amnesty International is calling on the UN Security Council to impose an arms embargo on South Sudan. The call came after confirmation that China delivered 1,000 tons of small arms and light weapons worth $38 million to the country just 2 weeks ago. Elizabeth Deng is a South Sudan researcher at Amnesty International. I suggested to her that there was growing impatience with South Sudan in the international community. Witness the recent EU sanctions against two South Sudanese military leaders. But did she really think the Security Council would be prepared to push through an arms embargo? China was, after all, a permanent member with veto powers.
IGAD, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, the body that's negotiating the peace agreement, and the UN. Both sides have said that they're prepared to take necessary measures to press the parties to commit to the peace agreement, implement the cessation of hostilities agreement, to stop the fighting. So we do think that there should be a will within the Security Council to end all transfers and supplies of arms to South Sudan. And the Security Council has condemned the violations of international humanitarian law. They've confirmed that these include extrajudicial executions and ethnically targeted violence. So it seems logical, given the likelihood that additional arms will be used to commit gross violations of human rights and humanitarian law, that the Security Council should be prepared to take this step to say that no more arms should flow into South Sudan.
What percentage of arms being used in this conflict in South Sudan are of Chinese origin?
Of course, we don't have the information to establish that. Just 2 weeks ago, 1,000 tons went into South Sudan. This includes grenade launchers, grenades, pistols, machine guns, and millions of rounds of ammunition. I mean, in addition, Amnesty knows that even prior to the conflict, there were large amounts of Chinese arms in South Sudan, that these arms are being used by both parties to the conflict. So yes, it seems like China is a large culprit in terms of supplying arms to South Sudan.
If an arms embargo were imposed, how long would it be before it would have any impact on the fighting?
Well, I mean, that's a difficult question, especially now that 1,000 tons of arms has just been supplied to the government. And we don't currently have precise information about the extent to which the opposition has been able to acquire arms. I think that both sides do, of course, have arms currently. It's hard to say how long it would take to have an effect on the fighting.
But it would be a hugely important symbolic gesture, wouldn't it, as well, an arms embargo?
Well, yes. I mean, definitely, because it's clear that that these arms are being used to commit gross human rights violations and violations of humanitarian law. It's also evident that, you know, the conflict is ongoing despite the cessation of hostilities agreement. So it's logical that the world should stop sending arms to South Sudan.
But looking back at previous conflicts, do arms embargoes work?
I think they're an important tool that the international community can use to help slow down conflicts and to really demonstrate to the world that they're committed to stopping violations of human rights.
Elizabeth Deng, researcher on South Sudan with Amnesty International.
Human rights.
Our human rights story this week takes us to Ghana, where activists are campaigning for greater protection and justice for victims of domestic violence. More and more victims are coming forward to report such crimes, which include child rape, but the authorities appear hamstrung by a lack of resources. Our correspondent Isaac Kaledshi has been talking to victims of domestic violence and asking what the authorities are doing to help them.
We were staying in Swedro with our stepfather, and the man, he was good to us, all of us. But me, I really liked him because he took care of us. He was everything every child would want from a father.
But this same stepfather took advantage of her innocence. He then raped repeatedly the girl who doesn't want us to mention her name.
And one night, that day, I was asleep though. So I was lying on the bed and he came. He was talking to me, like advising me about something that happened earlier on. He was holding my hand, doing all that. Later, all I could see was he was on me. But he told me I shouldn't tell anybody.
Violence against women and children continue to increase in Ghana. Unlike a few years ago, many people actually report rape cases to the police. In 2012, the Ghana Police Service recorded 15,271 cases of various forms of violence against women nationwide. an increase from 12,906 cases in 2011. ACP Elizabeth Dasa is the head of the Violence and Victim Support Unit, DOFSU, at the Ghana Police Service.
When you report to the police are enjoined by the law to receive the complaints and then interview the parties involved, even including children, and then give an extract and give you the necessary protection if you express such concern, help you take a few belongings from your home, and then refer you to a medical facility or take you there if you are really traumatized.
ACK Foundation is among institutions that support domestic violence victims. It was founded by a renowned gender activist and lawyer, Angela Dwamina Abuaji. Sarah Akono is the head of the anti-violence unit of the foundation.
What the anti-violence program seeks to do is to provide support for victims who have suffered some sort of violence. It could be domestic violence, in a form of sexual abuse, physical, and any other form of violence that is a human rights abuse.
Since 1999, ACK Foundation has been providing accommodation for domestic violence victims. Akono admits that it is not easy dealing with this kind of people. It is challenging.
You have DOFSU, which is supposed to help with one or two supporting areas where victims are concerned. You have some sort of reluctance from some officers sometimes. Sometimes, too, the court systems are prolonged, and as human as we are, most of the victims tend to give up.
One among the people who have benefited from ACK Foundation's service is Mami Che. She became a victim of domestic violence when she got married 48 years ago.
The challenges I had ended within 1 week after I came here. They have helped me to overcome my difficulties.
Sarah Akono says, putting smiles back on faces of those abused remains the foundation's priority. According to the 2008 health survey, almost 35% of women in Ghana experienced some form of physical, sexual, or emotional violence over the past 10 years in Ghana. Domestic violence is punishable in Ghana. If proven guilty, one can get up to 2 years imprisonment.
That was our correspondent, Isaac Kelechi, and there'll be another human rights story at the same time next week. Berlin, the German capital, is currently hosting an Open Knowledge Festival. Now, if that makes your head spin, it's all about sharing information, all sorts of information. And from there, it's just a short leap to a vision of open government, in which citizens can monitor governments and hold them accountable for their actions. Now, among those attending the Open Knowledge Festival are experts on data from the government of Sierra Leone, which has launched an open government initiative. Michael Scaturo reports.
Sierra Leone has long been polarized along political party lines, primarily because some feel the government is neglecting the interests of opposition communities. But the country has made big strides since the civil war ended in 2002. Open data and accountability in spending is seen as a key part to building a new Sierra Leone. President Ernest Bai Koroma explains what the plan is all about.
We come up with this open government initiative, an initiative where we give the ordinary man an opportunity for listening to the leaders in the country, for give a report card of their performance and ask questions who are relevant to what they're supposed to do in the country and make him hear the answer we never give. I believe say, it add to the inclusiveness, it add to the participatory governance.
To carry out the plan, data experts from Sierra Leone's government came to the Open Knowledge Festival in Berlin to learn how other countries have tackled the open data challenge. Among the people who attended the festival were Amadou Massale, the coordinator for the Open Government Initiative. He says Sierra Leone has completed step one of membership in the initiative.
But to qualify for membership in the Open Government Partnership, you have to meet four things: fiscal transparency, access to information, law, citizens' engagement and also declaring your assets by senior public officials. So we've accomplished that, and many other countries, which are bigger and richer and better developed than we are, have not been able to accomplish that. So we feel proud in that regard.
But Abubakar Kamara of the Budget Advocacy Network, an NGO that monitors the government's data openness progress, says that although the government still has far to go, he believes that this move is a positive one.
That will bring the government and the people together, that will bring trust between the government and the people, that will enable citizens to engage, to ask questions, why certain development projects are not going on. But with access to information, with open data, that will help.
Kamara says this process will also help people in the country track how money is spent, which will help them press their politicians for change.
So if we have an open budget process, or open budget, or open spending, that will enable development. It will be one of the drivers that will push development, that will enable citizens to demand development. Because if there is a budget, for instance, for an hospital, and citizens have access to that information, if that hospital is not built, they will ask a question. But if you don't have access to this information, then it will be a problem to even demand accountability.
Sierra Leone is using Facebook and WhatsApp to engage citizens in debate. Its information commissioner, Frank Manja, told me that he and his staff are in the process of creating an open data portal. He hopes that the website will be online by year end.
Michael Scatiro reporting from Berlin.
USA.
Time now to hear what you've been saying about this week's stories. And before we went on the air, I was joined in the studio by Mukia Luwina.
Hello, Mark. Africa Link recently asked for the listeners' preparedness on the face of Ebola, a deadly disease that has claimed lives in West African countries, namely Liberia, Ghana and Guinea.
Any feedback on that, Mukia?
We have a response from Ouma Samuel, who writes in from Uganda, saying there was a recent conference in Ghana on Ebola, and although one doctor died from the deadly disease in West Africa, but he believes the situation is under control.
Well, as Samuel says, it's good to know that governments and health workers are doing their best to address the problem. But the World Health Organization reported that the death toll has actually risen to over 600 and that 85 new cases of Ebola were discovered just last week. So we can only hope that people follow the guidelines and bring those who are infected to the health facilities.
Indeed, Mark. Thank you, Samuel, for bringing the topic to our attention again.
The big story last week was, of course, the FIFA World Cup. Did we have any response from our listeners on that?
Oh, yes, Mark. The 2014 World Cup came to an end last Sunday, and we saw Germany lift the cup finally. We received a lot of feedback from our DW Facebook page as well as emails. Johanna Jacob from Nigeria, for example, sent us an email. Johanna says that the letter G for Germany happens to be the seventh letter of the alphabet. It also happens to be the number of goals Germany scored against the host nation, Brazil. Julius Okot also wrote and called Germany a giant team that won the World Cup and wished the team the best as they celebrate their victory.
Right. Now, let's remind our listeners about our very own listeners' competition. Africa Link will be issuing three prizes to three separate winners, a tablet and two smartphones.
A report will be aired in the segment Africa on the Move on our Africa Link radio show. Also post an article on our webpage dw.de/Africa. You have 1 week to send us the right answer by mail or SMS. To qualify for the draw, you must include full name, age, residence and contact details.
Mukia Luwina, many thanks. And this is how you can get in touch with us. An SMS or text message to 491609575950. An email to feedback.africa@dw.de or a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. Remember, if you're a member of one of DW's listeners' clubs and you'd like to air your views on Your Say in person, then do send us an email with your phone number and we'll call you back and record your message for broadcast. A reminder of our main stories before we leave you. South Africans have been marking Nelson Mandela Day for the first time since he died last September. The rights group Amnesty International has called for an arms embargo on South Sudan. And we've also been hearing about the plight of victims of domestic violence in Ghana. And then we come to the end of another week here on Africa Link. Crispin Wakideo will be here on Monday. Do join him if you can. Have a pleasant weekend. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.